Hi, welcome to the Mental Wellness Journey. Discover the underlying causes of your emotional and physical symptoms and finally heal. I am extremely honored today to have Dr. Darren Ingles with us. He is a very prominent, esteemed physician in the world of Lyme and other healthcare issues. He is a licensed naturopathic doctor with more than 30 years experience in the healthcare field. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine and has been published extensively. Dr. Ingles is the author of The Lyme Solution, a five-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease. It's a comprehensive natural approach to treating Lyme disease. He has also been a Lyme and MS patient and has been able to reverse and control his symptoms using natural methods. Dr. Ingles specializes in Lyme disease, MS, autism, and chronic immune dysfunction. He uses diet, nutrients, herbs, homeopathy, immunotherapy to help his patients achieve better health. So thank you, Dr. Ingles. I really do feel honored to have you here today. I was beyond ecstatic when you responded to my email. So this was an area that I was and am hesitant to get into because of the complexity. And as a psychiatrist, for the last 25 years, very surprised myself that I am getting into the infectious disease world. So, but it's there.
Right.
I usually see people when they've gone through everything else and they're like, do you think it might be Lyme? But maybe I would love to hear your input. So you see the spectrum of people with Lyme disease, but when it reaches the brain and has neuropsychiatric manifestations.
Yeah, you know, I think for a lot of people, when they think of Lyme disease, you know, if they've heard of it, and particularly for where you live in the Chicago area, you know, the central Midwest is an endemic part of Lyme disease, you know, Wisconsin, Minnesota, northern Illinois. So a lot of people, when they think of Lyme disease, they think about classic symptoms where they get this bullseye rash, they get a headache, they get a fever, they get numbness, they get tingling, they get joint pain. You know, there's actually upwards of 100 different symptoms associated with Lyme disease. And I think, you know, probably the most overlooked symptoms tend to be these neuropsychiatric symptoms that can come out. So if someone's been, you know, having this ongoing bout of, you know, depression or what we call PANS, which is, you know, pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric syndrome, which we used to think was just associated with children, where overnight they start developing OCD, anxiety, and tics. We actually see a version of this that happens in adults too. So, you know, for anyone who's had these ongoing neuropsychiatric symptoms, I think it at least is worth investigating, you know, what are, you know, possibly some of these underlying causes. Now, there's Lyme, there's other types of infectious agents that can trigger this inflammation in the brain. And although you might experience headaches, you might experience other neurological symptoms that are more physical, sometimes it really is the mental things that people just don't really think that can be associated. Yet, you know, we've got now countless studies demonstrating how Lyme can affect the brain and start triggering these kind of reactions. So, you know, I think it's something that as healthcare providers really needs to be on our radar as a possibility when, you know, and I think the big differentiating factor with Lyme and some of these other infectious agents is really the onset. You know, these are people who are mentally quite well up until the point where they get infected. And then once they get infected, then they start having all these manifestations. Whereas, you know, I mean, other types of psychiatric illness often to be more insidious, slower onset. But when you start hearing about people who are pretty well up until a certain point and almost overnight, they start to experience, you know, these different type of, you know, psychiatric symptoms. Again, that would be a big red flag for me that, you know, maybe we need to at least rule out the possibility that it's Lyme disease or some other type of infectious agent.
And my thing, because I'm still relatively new in this field and learning a lot, but when it reaches the brain, is that early in the disease or is that later? I'm familiar with people that have been symptomatic for years and nobody's looked, so it's sort of easy because they've looked at everything else already. But at what point does it reach the brain and have those manifestations?
You know, I think it really varies. I mean, it's an individual response to Lyme. And I don't think I would necessarily say that, you know, you only get Lyme affecting the brain in early Lyme or late Lyme. I think it can happen really with both. I think we probably do tend to see it more in people that have had it for a longer period of time. At least that's been my experience. But there are some people when they get exposed, it just seems to affect the brain more quickly than in other people. So again, that red flag of sort of these overnight manifestations of, you know, neuropsychiatric symptoms would be the impetus to at least start investigating and testing people. But you know, again, in my practice, I tend to see it probably more associated with people that, as far as we can trace, you know, it may have been, you know, many months to years after someone had exposure. And I think that's a point that people should be aware of too, that a lot of people who get exposed to Lyme have no idea they got exposed. You know, the CDC says up to 80% of people when they get Lyme disease get this classic bullseye rash. But we know when you look at the medical literature, it's probably not more than 40% and perhaps even lower. In my practice, you know, people who have Lyme, it's probably less than 20%.
Oh, so wow.
For people who get it, I mean, it's kind of a hands down. Like when I had Lyme disease myself in 2002, and I had classic Lyme disease. But for me, I had all these symptoms. I was very sick, but I got bit behind my left leg. I couldn't see the rash. Someone else actually is the one that saw it. So, you know, these ticks like to go to your warm, moist areas of the body. So they like the back of your knees, underneath your butt cheeks, you know, under your armpit and your hairline. So it's often in areas that people aren't looking or they can't see. So it's possible too that someone could have gotten bitten, could have gotten that rash, and maybe, you know, they never noticed it. So again, for people who get it, it's sort of a telltale sign. There's nothing else that we're aware of that causes that classic rash. But for people who don't get the rash, it doesn't rule out the possibility of exposure.
And exposure, is it just from camping out or going into the deep woods? Or because these are the things that I'm less familiar because it's still relatively new to me.
Well, certainly for people who are outdoors people, particularly if you live in an endemic area. So I used to live in Connecticut. You know, New England is an endemic area. I mean, Lyme is named after Lyme, Connecticut. Connecticut. You know, I lived about 30 minutes from Lyme, Connecticut. But no, I mean, I used to have a practice in New York City. It's a concrete jungle, right? And I used to see people there that had Lyme disease. Okay. So I think, you know, this concept of, you know, you have to be out in the woods, you have to be camping, you have to be doing some sort of outdoor activity, you know, isn't necessarily the case. You know, when I got Lyme disease, I'm not really out in the woods. I'm not out camping. I'm not hiking trails. Okay. I'm pretty sure I got it through my dog. You know, my dog was outdoors doing her business, and just being out in the grass could be enough that, you know, can be anywhere on foliage. You know, you typically get Lyme disease through what's called a deer tick. So we first identified it really obviously through deer, but we now know that rodents are the biggest carriers of these ticks. So rats and squirrels and mice and other
all over
furry creatures. You know, even when I moved out to California last year, I was surprised. I mean, I probably have more Lyme patients in California than I had in Connecticut, just because the awareness of Lyme disease out here is much less than it was in Connecticut. But if, you know, where I'm out here in Southern California, I mean, we're surrounded by hills and again, we've got a lot of furry little creatures. So we've got the right vectors that can carry these ticks. And we know that this black-legged tick is out here in California as much as it is on the East Coast. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to be out in the middle of the woods to get exposed. But if you've been out gardening, if you've been out in your yard playing, again, depending on where you live in the country, I mean, it's possible you could have exposure. You know, look, we've reported Lyme disease in all 50 states. So, you know, even in Alaska. So, you know, I think there are certain states where definitely your risk is a lot less, but it certainly isn't zero. And, you know, most people travel too. So whether you acquire it where you live or if you happen to acquire it someplace where you've traveled to, you know, you have to look at places that you've been and it's possible that you've had exposure. I mean, I had one patient who's actually from Australia and the Australian government says that Lyme disease doesn't exist at all in the entire country.
Oh.
They've tested all the ticks and there's no Lyme there. I'm like, really? You tested all the ticks?
That's pretty cool.
But this patient is, you know, she and her husband are world travelers. I mean, they've been all over the world, and they've been to parts of the United States that's endemic for Lyme. And she had a positive Lyme test, even by the most conservative methods. But, you know, her government there is kind of refusing to believe that she has it. And she had a very difficult time getting treatment because they said, well, we don't have it here. I'm like, yeah, but you don't necessarily have to give it where you live. I mean, you can get it someplace that you might have traveled to. So, you know, it's a good idea, again, to kind of keep stock of where you've been as a possible risk factor for exposure.
I don't want to get too much into testing because, again, that's an area that's extremely complex. But yesterday, yeah. I have a patient who was coming for cognitive decline. And when I just did LabCorp Western blot, she had like 6 or 7 bands light up. But I'm a little bit hesitant because she's going to University Center for the infectious disease. And I'm talked to her about how they might respond. Because I, you know, she went there, I gave her somebody who is, you know, from ILADS referral, because can you speak to that a little bit? So people get a little bit of a flavor where they might get contradictory information.
Yeah, I mean, the Cliff Notes version is that the testing is quite poor. You know, the recommended testing by the CDC is a 2-tier system. So the first test is just a Lyme screen. It's an antibody test. It's a blood test. Mm-hmm. And if that tests positive, then they have you flex over to a secondary test called a Western blot, which is a more specific antibody test. But we know that the sensitivity of that test is only about 43%. So
that's pretty low in science. That's really low.
Extremely low. And again, I used to be a microbiologist. I used to do these tests for a living. And in the lab, if you have a test that's not at least 95% sensitive or specific, you don't really do it. So the fact that we've got all this data showing that the test is not sensitive, which means literally does not pick up more than half the people that have Lyme disease, tells you it's a terrible test.
Right.
Yet what a lot of doctors rely on. So, you know, if you go to the CDC's website, it even tells you that Lyme disease is a clinical diagnosis. So what that means is it's really based on your symptoms. So if you've got the signs and symptoms, in particular, if you live in an area that's endemic, all the test is really validating is that you've had exposure. Because look, you could have somebody who, you know, had got bit by a tick that carries Lyme, their immune system did what it's supposed to do. It got rid of it before it ever became a problem. They never got any symptoms. But if you do a blood test, you'll show signs that they had exposure because their antibodies responded the way the immune system's supposed to. So, you know, again, I don't do testing on people who don't have symptoms. I mean, if I test everybody in Connecticut, I would sure I'd find a lot of people that had a positive test that had no symptoms. So, you know, we typically don't treat people who don't have symptoms.
Right.
But this is where you have to gauge, you know, do people have the symptoms? Do they have the right exposure? Does the test validate that exposure? Because a lot of us in the Lyme world will treat people whose tests aren't necessarily CDC positive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, without getting into the intricacies of testing, you know, there are ways that you can kind of help deduce that, you know, people have had exposure. Because we know that some of these antibodies are very specific to Lyme. Some of them are not. So when we see people who have these Lyme-specific bands and they've got the clinical symptoms, we can feel fairly confident that, you know, they've had exposure.
Right.
But part of ruling out Lyme disease, too, is also looking at other possibilities. You've got to rule out other autoimmune diseases, other infections. So part of that process is not only are you testing for Lyme, but you're also ruling out other possibilities.
And since you brought it up, what other, I mean, the co-infections, because, I mean, again, I'm, as a psychiatrist, used to treating people all after clinical symptomatology, but you know, it's a whole nother, again, a whole nother world. What kind of co-infections or other illnesses do you look for?
So we know that a lot of the ticks that carry Lyme can also carry other things. So when they bite you and they have that blood meal, they can transmit Lyme. But we know when I lived up in the Northeast, up to like 33% of the ticks also carried something else. So again, part of our process as healthcare providers is that not only are we testing you for Lyme disease, but we're testing you for these. I mean, every time I go to a Lyme conference, I swear there's like more things we've learned that ticks carry. So, I mean, it's actually a pretty lengthy list, but there's a lot of other bacteria. So there's a thing called Bartonella. There's a blood parasite called Babesia, which is actually a cousin of malaria. There's one called Anaplasma, there's Ehrlichia, there's Mycoplasma. So, you know, we're usually testing for, you know, anywhere from 7 to 10, 12 different things at the same time, just to rule out the possibility that there's, you know, something else going on. And, you know, occasionally we'll come across people who don't have Lyme, but they do have one of these co-infections. So it's not necessarily that it's Lyme plus, it could be, but it could also be just the plus without Lyme. So it's a good idea to just, you know, cast as wide a net as possible, look for what we call, you know, tick-borne illness, and just, you know, rule them all out as possibilities. Because clinically, there's a lot of overlap in symptoms. I mean, if someone comes in with vague symptoms of headache and joint pain, you know, fatigue, I mean, any of these tick-borne illnesses can cause those symptoms. So there are some infectious agents that have symptoms that are a bit more characteristic to themselves, but by and large, a lot of the symptoms do tend to be fairly vague. And so we want to just make sure that we rule out all those possibilities.
Yeah, that's what I'm understanding too. Like Bartonella specific or especially has neuropsychiatric manifestations.
Right.
And also I'm getting a fair number of people that seem to have mold and Lyme.
Yeah, mold and Lyme really go hand in hand. I'd say the overwhelming majority of patients I see who test positive for Lyme do tend to have issues related to mold, and whether that's mold allergy, so actually having an immune reaction to mold spores. And again, if you live in an environment that has a lot of moisture and humidity, you know, mold is everywhere. But you can also get something called mycotoxicity. And this is particularly people who've been in water damaged buildings. So if your home's ever had a roof leak, or you've had a pipe that's leaking, or you know, your bathtub has a leak in it, that long-standing water, some of these molds can actually start to secrete these things called mycotoxins that you breathe in, and they can be very damaging to your nervous system and very damaging to your lungs. So, you know, part of that process, yeah, is always looking. I'm at a point now when I test people for Lyme, I just test for mold and mycotoxicity at the same time. Because again, clinically, there's a lot of overlap in symptoms. And because the treatment's completely different, you know, it's a good idea to know up front what you're dealing with, because it may take you down a different treatment path.
Yes, and that's another thing, because at this point, I'm sending a lot of people along to other doctors that specialize in this because of the complexity. So antibiotics, antifungals, how do you, herbal preparations, how do you treat, and yeah, what kind of responses are you getting? And do you treat people with traditional antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications?
So for Lyme disease, and I'm a naturopathic doctor by training, so you know, I have a lot of experience using botanical medicine, using herbs. I find they work extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you know, over 20 years of practice, I've probably written less than 5 prescriptions for antibiotics for Lyme disease. There is a place for it. I mean, I think in acute Lyme disease, people whose exposure really is new, antibiotics work quite well, or they can work well. Again, we've got a discrepancy between the IDSA, this is the conventional infectious disease doctors, versus the ILADS doctors. These are the doctors who have expertise in tick-borne illness, but they're not all necessarily infectious disease doctors. And the two camps are really quite, have opposite opinions on the length of time to treat Lyme. You know, Lyme disease is an extremely slow-growing bacteria. And to put it in perspective, you know, most bacteria in your body replicate about every 10 to 20 minutes. Lyme disease replicates every 1 to 16 days. So that's very, very slow. And, you know, much like if someone gets tuberculosis, you know, we treat them with a triple antibiotic cocktail for 9 months to a year. And the reason is it's a very slow growing organism. Well, Lyme is more slow growing than tuberculosis. So why they think 10 to 21 days of antibiotics is sufficient to treat this slow growing organism doesn't really make biological sense. So a lot of people in the ILADS camp, if they're going to use antibiotics, will typically use at least 6 weeks, if not longer, to really ensure that you've eradicated the organism. But I rarely see, and I think most of us in our world rarely see, that acute Lyme patient. The people who get that condition are typically very ill. So often they're off to their primary care doctor, or actually even urgent care or a hospital, because they're that sick. And so often they're getting early treatment with those folks. So I'm seeing more of the chronic Lyme patients that, you know, have had it for months to years, in which case, again, herbal therapy works quite well. So, you know, if I've got patients who've got different types of neuropsychiatric symptoms, you know, I always like to, you know, start with these therapies first and see how they respond. I'm not a psychiatrist. I actually don't feel very comfortable using psychiatric medicines for people who do need it.
It's funny how
we refer off to to you guys to do that, and I'll manage the other end. But I think, again, you know, there's just so many nuances with the different psych meds that unless you've got a lot of experience using them, and I certainly don't, I'd much rather professionals like you handle that part.
Yeah, no, actually, it's interesting because it's what we're comfortable and what we've been trained in. And again, I'm entering the herbal world much more. And it's actually kind of thrilling when I get a patient that doesn't want medicines, because, you know, now my patient population is changing and I see really significant improvement in treatment without using psychiatric medicines, which is wonderful too, to see, like, it gets better without. This is going to be really out there, and you can tell me again, because I have a lot of book knowledge, but I don't have a lot of clinical knowledge. What about getting passed from mother to child Lyme?
Yes, we now have several studies showing vertical transmission from mother to child. So definitely if mom is pregnant, there is an increased risk of passing it on to her baby. So we do know that if mothers get treated during pregnancy, it significantly reduces the risk of her ability to pass it on to her baby.
Okay, but that means there can be people out there who got it from their mother.
Absolutely.
Okay, and the manifestation. Because I'm starting to move into the world that all, like just about all psychiatric illnesses really do have a source of something. And that's what the series is about, that it's not just, you know, medications just treat symptoms. They don't treat causes at all.
Right. And we know from the mothers that happen to have Lyme, if they pass it on to their baby, there's an increased risk of birth defects. There's an increased risk of stillbirth. There's an increased risk of developmental delays. So when I start to see, you know, particularly, you know, often moms find out, of course, after they've delivered that they have Lyme, and then they're concerned about their child. So, you know, often we will test their children to see if they've had exposure. Depending on the age of the child, we know that, you know, certainly for the first 6 months after birth, you know, you're carrying some of mom's antibodies. Mm-hmm. So these IgG antibodies, you know, aren't very helpful because we can't distinguish what's baby versus what's mom. But after the 6 month, those antibodies are gone basically from mom. And so anything after that point is typically made by the child. And there's other types of antibodies, particularly called IgM. That's more of an acute antibody. If we ever see IgM antibodies, because IgM doesn't pass the placenta. So if we ever see IgM in a young child or an infant that's positive for Lyme, then that's, we know that they've gotten exposed.
And you mentioned PAN. So that's pediatric. What is it? Pediatric
autoimmune neuropsychiatric syndrome. Yeah.
Yes. And you're seeing not just in children, but in adults, something kind of the equivalent of that or similar to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's that similar manifestation where, again, it typically happens overnight where people start getting anxiety. You know, in kids, I see more of the OCD and tics. In adults, I still see some OCD, more anxiety. I don't see as much with the tics with the adults as I do in the children. But again, it's one of these things that just all of a sudden people overnight, they start experiencing debilitating anxiety, depression. A lot of them do develop these OCD behaviors and just kind of came out of nowhere. So again, for me, big red flag that we should rule out Lyme and one of these other infectious agents.
Wow, that's, you know, again, just astounding. How surprised are people about the neuropsychiatric manifestations? Is that a major complaint of people? Because brain fog, I see people with brain fog, but you're seeing them more, I think, a more across the board symptom.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very common problem. Again, when we talk about inflammation in the brain, depending on what part of the brain gets affected, that sort of dictates how it's going to manifest. So for some people, it can be sensory. For other people, it can be emotional. For other people, it can be cognitive. So it varies across the board, but to have people experience, I mean, I've had people that have had, you know, hallucinations and, you know, visual changes and I said depression and anxiety and sleep disturbances and mania. You know, wow. There's such a wide variety of ways that it can affect the brain. But again, I think what ends up happening, you know, people start to experience these symptoms, they get shuttled off the psychiatrist, they start getting, you know, all the different meds, and then it's now going through the litany of medications. And of course, as you know, a lot of these are used off label. So then they start getting into some of the heavy duty, not just the antidepressants, but now they start getting into a lot of the, you know, the seizure medicines is very common to try and help control symptoms. But, you know, the risk of that, of course, is that, you know, the side effects of a lot of these medications is pretty significant. Plus, it also masks the symptoms. So sometimes it makes it a little bit harder to figure out, if you're using other therapies, what's actually helping. So, you know, again, unless it's really a serious situation where we need to intervene immediately, you know, my preference is always to try and use other natural methods. And, you know, we've also got a lot of other nutritional things that we can do that help with alleviate a lot of these symptoms. I mean, we have a lot of great natural antidepressants and anxiety. And so for things that are again, not at the point where it's serious or life-threatening, again, we can intervene. And often these therapies work quite well for folks while we continue to work on these underlying issues.
Yeah, because we're talking about the infection with Lyme itself, but what it does to the body and the symptoms manifesting secondary to that and the support around that can be extremely helpful and symptom reducing too. But I think a really important thing is to understand and just to have it on your radar, because if people get sent down the psychiatry path, they get on medicines and medicines and medicines, and then they forget about the onset. And everything is, you know, when you get people with no family history of psychiatric diseases at all, but they've been on medications for years, they forget the onset. And I want people to really just even have it on their radar. I'm astounded at how many people. I'm like, oh my gosh.
You know, it just sparked something I thought I'd mention that I think has been really interesting. One of the things I've seen in the last year, especially, I've had several patients come in complaining of depersonalization, which seems to be a common theme with some of these tick-borne illnesses. And maybe I'm sure you can explain that a little bit better than I would, but I've now had several patients that this has been their primary complaint, even more than the physical symptoms.
Yeah, and anybody who gets I usually see the kind of the train wrecks where somebody decides they have conversion. I don't know if I was talking to you. They have conversion disorder or somatoform disorder. It's like they're making it up. And I'm like, oh, this is not traditional. But depersonalization, there's a very small subgroup of people that have a psychiatric manifestation that I remember seeing way back. But for you to be seeing people with depersonalization, that's an unusual symptom, psychiatric symptom. And and again, I think it has to do with the unusual symptoms, or if the person that they're seeing that are trying to treat them are like, gee, that doesn't fit in with typical things. Again, I'm astounded at how much there is. And I had this one young woman with a lot of anxiety and some tics and obsessions and some eating disorder, but she and her family didn't want any psychiatric manifestations with Lyme, but she's doing so much better. And it's, you know, so don't let people talk you into something if it doesn't feel right to you.
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about this last week briefly, and I think it's a good thing for people to be aware of. You know, if you've had these problems and you've gone off to your doctor and they've given you this nebulous, you know, conversion disorder, somatoform disorder, you know, I kind of feel like that's sort of the lame way out of, you know, we don't know what's wrong with you, so we're just going to call it this.
And then blame you, and then they blame you.
Right.
Like you're the cause.
Yeah, I mean, I have a young girl I'm working with. She's 15 years old, and she went to the local children's hospital here. And I mean, she can barely stand up. I mean, she's got significant Lyme disease. And, you know, her initial diagnosis when she was admitted was conversion disorder. And I'm like, you can clearly see. I mean, you know, the whole thing with conversion disorder, I mean, that people do get these symptoms, but it's sort of like their body's manifesting it. And yet she's got a positive Lyme test. And, you know, just, it's been a fight with the doctors at the local children's hospital, because again, they don't really believe that Lyme disease exists in California, even though the CDC says California is the 5th fastest fastest growing state for Lyme disease in the country. So, you know, we've got this unfortunately, this battle with a lot of conventional medical providers about getting people properly diagnosed and ultimately treated. But, you know, to pass off, you know, a young girl who was very healthy, she was an athlete, you know, as, yeah. you know, conversion disorder, it's very frustrating.
Yeah, listening to parents, you know, listening to parents and listening to the patient to me says, you know, everything. Conversion disorder is like from the 1800s when they didn't have to explain it. And it is in your head, but it literally is in your head. It is in the brain. And the difficult thing is a lot of academic centers are much more conservative. And I don't want to get into politics, but they don't recognize Lyme or chronic Lyme exists, and they're very narrow in what they look at. But if they're starting to blame you for your symptoms, or a lot of times with teenagers especially, I get when they're being manipulative, they're trying to do this, they're being purposeful. But I want people, again, to look outside, because it just doesn't fit, and it's very maddening, no pun intended. So what, how do you, because you get people that have an idea they have Lyme, because you're a Lyme specialist, or somebody has pointed them in your direction. Is there anything other than the acute infection, which people get really sick and, you know, fever and rash and, you know, flu-like symptoms? But what, you know, is it just, I know the other extreme when people have been everywhere else, then they come to me and we don't have anything else to look at. So we can look at the chronic infections. How do you get people to start thinking about Lyme, or just, why would somebody start to think about Lyme? Just.
Yeah. Well, again, because the symptoms are very broad, and there's upwards of 100 different symptoms associated with Lyme. I think for me, again, when
I started 100 different symptoms,
there's about 100 different symptoms associated with Lyme disease. So again, it varies quite a bit. So I'm always concerned when I hear about arthritic symptoms, so joint muscle problems, and neurological symptoms, that combination of the two. For me, you know, again, when you start hearing about people who've been getting joint pain, muscle aches, and the different neurological or psychiatric symptoms, that combination of the two, there aren't very many things that really trigger both. You know, there's a lot of things that can just cause arthritis. There's other things that can cause neurological symptoms. When you hear about both, you know, for me, that breeds some sort of infectious agent, and at least worth investigating and ruling it out. So that's again, one of my red flags of where people need to be tested. And for people, again, who aren't sure, or maybe they had a test and the test kind of came back, you know, either wishy-washy or negative, you know, I actually have a quiz online that people can take. And, you know, depending on how you score, that can give you a pretty good idea about what your risk or exposure has been. Dr. Richard Horowitz, who has a much more expanded quiz, he's actually done research on that quiz and validated it and found that it's pretty much as accurate as doing Lyme testing. You know, so if you start to score very high on these quizzes, you know, there's a way to give you a pretty good idea about whether you might be at risk.
And what about, you said treatment, and it's a really slow-growing infection. So how long are, like, people on, I'm going to say regimens of botanicals, how long does it take people to get better from Lyme?
It really varies from person to person. You know, I'll say everybody's Lyme is their Lyme, and the way it impacts them, it may be different than how it affects other people. So, I mean, I think 6 months to a year for people who've had Lyme for a while is pretty common. However, I do expect to see improvement as we're going on with treatment. So it's not like, you know, 6 months to a year before we expect to move the needle in the right direction. And, you know, ultimately, I find with Lyme, it's really about treating the terrain. You know, it's not just about killing the bug. That's a small part of everything we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to get you healthy. So that means, you know, we're dealing with your gut health, since, you know, 80% of your immune function stems from the gut. We're getting your diet straight. We want to make sure you're eating the right foods to help your body, and particularly how it affects your body pH. So I talk a lot in my book about specifically an alkaline ketogenic diet to help people, you know, move the needle in that direction. And that's all the lifestyle things. I mean, you need good sleep, you know, sleep's when your brain detoxifies. It's when all those neurons repair themselves, your tissue repairs. So a lot of Lyme patients don't sleep very well. They don't get good quality sleep. You know, I like people to move their body, even as tired as they are and as sick as they are, anything they can do to move their body helps. So, you know, there's really a whole process, you know, and working with the whole person head to toe to help, you know, deal with Lyme. And I think a lot of doctors, you know, they get kind of hung up on just killing the bug. And honestly, it's like, we have very little evidence that once you get exposed, that you're able to get rid of it completely. You know, it's not that you can't be, you know, we hate to use the C word, cure. But I mean, I have people who get treated and they are 100% symptom free. So are they cured? In my world, I say, yes. Is it possible that they could have a relapse somewhere down the line? You know, it's possible. And I have seen patients where that's happened. So, you know, I think we can get people to a point where they can live symptom free. But at that point, it's probably really about maintaining good health, good mental health, good physical health. And in that, you know, I think it's kind of like, you know, if you get chicken pox when you're 5 years old, you can get shingles when you're 55. And it's the same virus that stays in your body for 50 years. It's just when your immune system is compromised, it starts to come out. And I think Lyme can do the same thing. So, you know, unfortunately, our testing has not evolved to the point where we can measure Lyme directly in the body. So we're always looking at the immune response to Lyme. And hopefully our technology will change and we'll be able to actually figure out, do we ever get rid of it 100%? We've got some good evidence out of Johns Hopkins University that even with antibiotic therapy, we kill a lot of the Lyme organisms, but not all of them. There's this small percentage they call persister cells, and these persister cells are just resistant to treatment. So these are probably the ones that hang on and continue to cause problems. So I know Dr. Horowitz has talked a lot about different antibiotic regimens to try and attack these persister cells. You know, we may get to that point, but it's an evolving field, and we're still trying to find ways to be more clever than the bug. But right now, you know, from my standpoint, again, if we can really focus on getting people healthy.
Yeah, as you said, the terrain. And one of my colleagues says, you know, treating Lyme is really like being a good functional medicine doctor. It's taking care of the body and getting everything up to snuff, which is all the lifestyle things, so that people do much better. It's not just, as you're saying, going after the actual bug, which is all the support around it, but people do get better. People do get less symptomatic.
Absolutely. And the way I think of it, you know, kind of like having Lyme, you know, if you're standing on the lake in the morning and it's a nice calm lake and a motorboat goes blowing by, the boat can be long gone, but the waves are still rippling in the wake. And Lyme's kind of same thing, that, you know, even if we were successful at eradicating the organism, you know, Lyme sometimes leaves kind of this path of destruction in the body. It can disrupt your hormone system. Hypothyroidism after Lyme is extremely common. Some women start complaining that their menstrual cycle is off after they have Lyme. We often, after Lyme, people get very sensitive to different things. They can have food allergies, environmental allergies. So often we're having to deal with the allergy part. And so, you know, there's all these different pieces that we're kind of sometimes having to pick up after, you know, we've dealt with the Lyme part. But again, it's all about getting the person healthy. And again, I'm an environmental medicine doctor really by training. So it's still looking at all these other environmental factors that influence health. So it's making sure, you know, your home environment's clean, you're not using toxic chemicals, you're not putting, you know, toxic stuff on your body. Anything we can do to reduce your body burden of potential toxins, improve your detoxification pathways, all that, is as much as we can optimize that, is going to help you get healthier faster.
Right. So your doctor that's treating you for Lyme isn't ignoring the actual Lyme. They're treating you. And that's the important thing. Because I know some people get dissuaded, but I'm not treating the Lyme. And, you know, it's trying to help them understand the bigger picture. Now, just again, I don't want to get them political, but I do want to give people information that's helpful to them. Can you... you were talking about one organization for Lyme, and then I'm most familiar with ILADS, which is the International Lyme and Associated Diseases
Society. Yeah, it's International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. So these are doctors who, this organization really educates doctors on tick-borne illness. So again, it's not just Lyme disease, but it's all these other co-infections. And, you know, every year there's a conference and other ongoing continuing education programs just to help teach doctors, you know, how to identify these different tick-borne illnesses and different ways they can be treated. So again, the Infectious Disease Society of America, these are the conventional infectious disease doctors. They have a very different opinion on Lyme disease, that it's an easy to treat infection, 10 to 21 days of antibiotics, and that's all it really needs. You know, for people who do have, you know, Lyme in their brain, they do recommend IV antibiotics, but again, typically for about 21 days. So it's really disheartening. The IDSA is coming out with new guidelines. I don't think they're officially published yet, but I think the new recommendations are going to lower it down to only 14 days, 10 to 14 days. So
yeah, and if you're still symptomatic after you get treatment, that's telling you something, you know?
Yeah,
and again, I'm not trying to get, but I want people to know that if they feel like they've been treated, but they're still having symptoms, there's some professionals that are concerned that they're not getting as much treatment as they need.
Well, I think this is a great example. I mean, if you had a sinus infection and you went on antibiotics and you got a little bit better, and at the end of a week or 10 days, your ENT doctor said, well, you've done 10 days, you're fine. You're like, but my sinus is still hurt. I still got congestion. I mean, an ENT wouldn't hesitate to, you know, continue your course of antibiotics or maybe change your antibiotic regimen. But that doesn't happen with Lyme. You know, it's just sort of this hard line. You've been treated, it's done, it's over. And even if you're still symptomatic, at least most doctors in the conventional world, I think, kind of tend to just say, well, you're done. And again, I don't know where in medicine we kind of stopped using our heads and using common sense that, you know, particularly if there's been some improvement, but people aren't completely improved, you know, why wouldn't you continue that course? You know, your biggest risk, of course, with antibiotics is you got to watch your gut. You know, it's very, you know, you can't kill the bad stuff without killing the good stuff. So you've really got to do a lot to protect our microbiome. And I mean, but there are ways around that through probiotics and other things like that, that we can help try and keep the gut intact as much as possible. But
which are why herbal preparations are, I, you know, I'm finally coming around to realize that they're more gentle on the body, and you don't kill as much good stuff with that, but it's almost more specific. I'm not sure if I'm being as eloquent as I need to be regarding that.
Yeah, I mean, when we use herbs, I mean, by and large, I rarely get a lot of gastrointestinal side effects like we might see with traditional antibiotics. So there's something about the plant-based antimicrobials that our gut just seems to deal with a little bit better, yet they still seem to be effective at dealing with these other types of infections. So, you know, we've got, I mean, tons and tons of research on various herbs and how they affect, you know, not just Lyme, but other different bacteria. So we've got a good arsenal of antimicrobials and herbs. And
yeah, which my entry into the functional medicine world is just like, they can't be powerful enough, which is probably a traditional physician standpoint, but it's amazing. And, you know, going back to nature and really, you know, the world can figure itself out. And it's just, I love talking to naturopathic physicians because they have the experience that I have with the more traditional, and they have the confidence and know what works. So,
well, I mean, I have patients that if we start them on herbs, you know, one of the herbs we use for treating Lyme is called cat's claw. And cat's claw is a well-studied herb. I mean, they've got a lot of research on its antimicrobial effects. And we use a tincture of it, so it's a liquid extract. And all the people literally start with one drop a day, and they'll start to get a die-off reaction. I mean, it's one drop of an herb. And, you know, people will say that these herbs aren't potent. So, again, I think for people who say that, these are people who just don't have experience with botanical medicine. And just
And there's a whole world of physicians that don't. And I'm saying it not to be silly, but just how potent they can be and not understanding that. You know, here I'd been a physician for a really long time and just not understanding the power of herbs. And yeah, so I'm that's why I want people to know.
I mean, consider how many conventional medications are derived from herbs. I mean, there's a lot of them, there are several drugs that are used in cancer chemotherapy that are derived from from herbs. There are other antibiotics that we derive from herbs. I mean, my gosh, penicillin came from mold.
Exactly. And you're like, wait a minute.
And I think the concept that we have to take a component out of a plant and then concentrate it and make a drug out of it that somehow makes it better. We know that the whole of a plant, since plants are made of, you know, multiple different constituents and chemicals, they have a synergistic effect. When you try and take one component of the plant, I mean, my gosh, they did this with St. John's wort for years, trying to find what was that one part of St. John's wort that helped with depression. And it kept changing over the years. But we think it's, you know, hypericin. Oh no, now we think it's something else. So, you know, it's been one of these things where I don't think some people in medicine have really appreciated how these plants work as a whole. And, I found like there's an herb called artemisia that's used a lot in Lyme disease and co-infections. There is an extract of artemisia called artemisinin, which is, you know, a very potent alkaloid in the plant that we know has antimicrobial effects. But when you take pure artemisinin, you're actually at risk of damaging your liver. Whereas when you take whole plant artemisia, that doesn't happen. So, you know, we run this risk when we start trying to isolate those single components of herbs. And I know why they do it, because they think they're getting a more potent effect. But by and large, you'll find a lot of plants, that's not the case. And using the whole plant actually works quite well.
Yeah. And again, I've been astounded where I can give people drops of things and they do get a big reaction, and just learning to respect the body. And again, I'm speaking for maybe what I think are some viewers that will have, you know, come from a more conventional world, and they're coming because what we're doing in the conventional world isn't working, because in psychiatry, things haven't changed, you know, since 1990. So, you know, they help a lot of people, but clearly they're not helping enough. And, you know, it's different. And that's why one reason I'm doing this series, because I, you know, there's other solutions out there that work, and we have to think about things differently. If what we were doing was working, it would be fine, but it's not. And that's why. Because there's a lot of people that cycle through psychiatric medicine and cycle through and cycle through and cycle through. You know, and we're not treating something if it poops out after 3 months or 6 months. We're not treating the underlying thing. I mean, it's great if it helps a little bit, but that's why we need to be looking. And that's why I have Dr. Ingles today, because, you know, you're just a wealth of information. And, you know, it's just astounding. Again, and it's actually really, really hopeful, because, you know, helping people in ways that I never thought I would be helping people, and looking at things. And that's, to me, the power. It's not like, oh my gosh, I have Lyme. It's like, oh my gosh, you have something we know what to do with. And it can be really, really hopeful. So that's why. So thank you so much. I really, really, really appreciate
Oh, my pleasure.
With us today. Now, I always ask people about, we had med school notes where, you know, somebody had to was responsible for taking the notes for that lecture. And we always had the take home point at the end. What was in the old days when we did mimeograph? It was like purple or something. I don't know. It was really a long time ago. What would be your, I know it's really ridiculous to try to summarize everything, but what would you say would be the one take home message?
Well, I think the biggest take home message I would have, again, if you're someone who's been dealing with, you know, this ongoing, you know, psychiatric illness, particularly if it's been coupled with other physical neurological symptoms and or arthritic symptoms, you know, you really should, you know, find someone in your area that can, you know, start testing you for Lyme or some of these co-infections. At least rule it out as a possibility, because again, it'll take you down a very different treatment path, but potentially something that's really addressing that underlying cause. I just see so many people that have these symptoms, and it's just a shame that they're just not getting tested at all. Right. And
therefore, it's not being considered.
It's just not being considered. So, you know, if this has been part of your path, then it's a good idea to seek out someone in your area who can, you know, do that proper investigation for you and find out if that's part of what's going on for you.
And I think you have, and I'm like, here is your book, which I think is wonderful for people. And this isn't Dr. Ingles promoting it. It's me promoting it. And you have a free offer for people if they're interested to learn more about Lyme?
Yeah, we'd love for people to join us. We have regular newsletters and information about Lyme disease and other just general health issues. So if you sign up at our website, we've got a free offer for you. It's my top 10 immune boosting recipes. So I'm a really simple cook. So I had someone help me. You know, we put together a list of food, you know, great recipes that help support your immune system. They're quick, they're easy to make, they're really delicious. So we've got a free download for people. If they sign up with us, they'll get that in their inbox right away. And we'd love to share that with our folks.
Thank you so much. It's been an extraordinary hour. It really, really has. And I want to thank you so much, Dr. Ingalls.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.